Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I am Giuseppe Porcaro.
And I'm Gunt van Wolf.
And I'm Gregory Kless.
And Alicia Garcia Herrero.
And for this episode today, we are going to explore whether the COVID-19 crisis is an opportunity to boost the euro as a global currency. The euro became an international currency when it was created two decades ago, but its internationalization peaked as early as 2005, and it has never challenged the dollar's dominance. Its international status declined with the euro crisis. Nowadays, faced with a US administration willing to use its hegemonic currency to extend its domestic policies beyond its borders, Europe is reflecting on how to promote actively the internationalization of the euro to ensure its autonomy. So this brings us very much into the core of the current geopolitical headlines. But promoting a more prominent role for the euro and challenging the dollar's dominance are difficult and might involve some radical changes to the fabric of the monetary union. Gregory, what the euro is missing or should do to be a dominant global currency?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting question, because I think you make the right distinction when you distinguish international currency, which the euro is clearly, and dominant currency, which in my view it is not. And the only really dominant currency that we have is actually the dollar, and the euro never reached that point. And so something that we discuss in the papers that we have written with Guntram recently is what historically are the determinants to be a dominant currency, not only an international currency. And basically, in that paper, we list like seven criteria that a country needs to fulfill to really be a dominant currency. And we really think that the euro and the eurozone does not fulfill those seven criteria. Basically, if I may sum them up very quickly, I think they are the following. The first one is that you need to be a large and growing economy. That's a very important thing. The second thing is that you need to have a free movement of capital. The third thing is that, of course, your public authorities need to be willing to have a currency that is global and dominant. The fourth one is that your currency needs to be stable in all aspects, financially, politically, judicially, in terms of price stability, in terms of fiscal stability, etc. So it needs to be stable. That's the first one. The fifth one is the ability actually of the country issuing the currency to provide a large and elastic supply of safe assets. And the sixth one is the existence of developed financial markets. So that's also very important. And the seventh one is the fact that to be really truly dominant, a currency need for the issuing country to have a significant geopolitical and so basically in the paper we look at all those different determinants and we realize that the euro does not fulfill those seven criteria. And we enter the details of why and what it could do to fulfill all these criteria.
Thank you, Gregory. And Guntram, you in the paper, you are reflecting on the current circumstances in connection with the COVID-19 crisis. And you analyze, but what is the opportunity there to boost the role of the euro as an international currency?
Yes, thank you, Giuseppe. I think it's important to realize that all seven criteria need to be really fulfilled if one wanted to become a dominant currency. So it's clear that there's no sort of fudging around and there's no easy way to become a dominant currency. Ultimately, big steps are needed to really achieve the status of a dominant currency. Now, we cannot discuss all of those in this paper, which is why we focused on two aspects that currently play a role in the debate and that we consider particularly important in any case for the European economy and the European overall situation. The first point that we make is related to safe assets. So as we have heard, to be an international currency that is globally used, there needs to be a big supply of safe assets. The problem being that in the EU, the amount of safe assets, so let's say AAA rated assets, has actually declined in the last 10 years due to downgrades and the bad economic performance of some countries. So I think the first point is really how can we increase the supply of safe assets? And I think there basically we are saying there's two ways. One way is to increase the growth performance of our countries and thereby improve the ratings of those countries. So if Italy, for example, only had 0.5 percentage point more of productivity growth, the amount of safe assets in the Eurozone would immediately increase dramatically by some two trillion euros. But equally important, and since it's not so trivial to actually increase productivity growth, is of course the creation of a debt level, a safe asset, a debt bond that is issued at the EU or Eurozone level. And there, basically, a lot of debate has been focusing in the last months around corona bonds and all of these terms that were rather ill-defined. Now there is a clear path forward, which is basically the Commission proposal to issue debt as the European Commission, backed by the EU budget, in the order of magnitude of 750 billion. Now, 750 billion is a good first step, but it's certainly not yet a deep liquid market that would be sufficient to attract and become really a dominant currency. But at least it's a good first step, and I think it should be welcomed as a good first step. Now, we also, I think, say that ultimately, if one really wanted to have a massive EU-level debt that goes well beyond this, I think we will have to discuss the treaty foundations. But for the time being, I think this 750 billion is a good first step and creates really a safe asset. Now, the other point is really the growth strategy. And I think that I mentioned already, it's very important to be a dynamic and thriving market, because only then will international investors actually find it interesting to invest in your area, in your region, and only then you become an international currency of relevance. So really the economic dynamism, the growth strategy, whether or not investors believe that there is a future in your growth model or not, this is really fundamental. And so the whole discussion about the growth package, the recovery package, how we can achieve green growth, digital growth, what are the new technologies, what kind of industrial policy. This is really, really important for the international role of the euro.
But if it's not going to be the euro who's going to achieve this this status in for all these reasons, I mean, what would happen if the yuan would be the next dominant currency, Alicia?
Thank you, Giuseppe. It kind of sounds like jumping from a low growth region to a high growth region, hoping that the other conditions that Gregory mentioned will be automatically fulfilled. It so happens that they aren't there yet for the yuan either. Most importantly, the yuan happens to operate in a non-convertible environment. So, you know, in a way that in itself kills the idea of the yuan being immediately even a reserve currency of any sort, although, you know, officially the yuan already makes part of the SDR basket, which is kind of interesting if you think about it. But having said that, I think the question is absolutely well taken. If you think further, why? Because maybe we are entering a world where currencies could become, I wouldn't say dominant, but at least international reserve currencies, without lifting the lid, which is a very important lid, by the way, of capital controls. Meaning, can China, and this is the key question, manage to, at the same time, have an international currency for whatever purpose, and we can have lots of ideas on why China might need this at the current juncture, given the extraterritoriality of the dollar, etc., and keep, if not full control, at least awareness of where yuan-denominated liabilities and assets are going. Where are they? And this, of course, brings us to the wonderful technological advance of our time, which is, of course, blockchain and central distributed ledgers, because that means, I mean, I'm going to challenge that this idea in a moment, but the whole point is, which many people are writing about, can the yuan become an international currency just for the mere fact that all of those transactions cross-border can be well recorded and thus can be subject to control, if not full control? I just happen to think that there are many other things you need, as Gregory mentioned. If it's just a refuge country, so you want to kind of hide away from the dollar, maybe that's okay. So if you think of the yuan substituting anything like, you know, from any type of e-currency or private e-currency that circulates out there, Bitcoin being an example, maybe okay. But that's not a dominant currency. For a dominant currency, you need price stability. You need, you even mentioned it, Gregory, like legal stability. I mean, you need to make sure that you can rely on the transactions carried out through this currency. And I think, to me, we're very far from that now. So I don't think we're talking about dominance of the yuan. We're talking about the yuan becoming a kind of different type of international currency. So whenever it comes to avoiding the dollar, the yuan offers an opportunity, maybe more than the euro, because we're talking about a different ecosystem. Yeah, China has created already a cross-border international payment system, CIPS, now finalizing already yuan settlement. So there is actually yuan settlements across central banks between the Russian Central Bank, the PBOC, et cetera, which can avoid SWIFT. So all of that is well placed for the role of the renminbi as a digital currency. But that doesn't mean that every transaction will go through renminbi.
Alisa, if I may interrupt. So basically you are saying that the yuan is positioning itself more as a concurrent or a competition to Bitcoin and other digital currencies. That's the space that they are trying to carve?
Yes, but on the back... it's a good point. On the back of a massive economy behind. So, you know, the Bitcoin doesn't have an economy behind. The renminbi can be much bigger than Bitcoin, because any transaction that I wish to carry out in renminbi, imagine Russia-China trade, avoiding the dollar, I can do that. So it's a very powerful substitute as concerns, and this is nothing to do with third parties, China's interest with other countries. Think about sanctions, yeah? Think about Iran, think about Russia, think about... That, I think, is very obviously the case with a digital currency. Beyond that, I just think that investors, before they buy, you know, an asset denominated in renminbi and really feel that this is comparable to the dollar, I think there's a long way to go. That's my opinion.
Guntram, what do you think?
I basically wanted to take a step back and basically look at the global picture, right? And the global picture is one where also in the course of the pandemic, I think we are seeing a weakening of the United States. I mean, the political turmoil that's currently ongoing is quite dramatic, and the economic numbers and the sort of social issues and the stability of the country is really not looking very convincing at the moment. While at the same time, China has relatively well escaped this pandemic, and Europe is actually doing quite okay at this stage. It's certainly doing better than the United States, it seems to me. And so I think one question is really, as we see this shift of global power, the landscape, is there going to be at some stage perhaps more of a competition, not one dominant currency, but several currencies that play a role and actually have a role that goes a bit beyond just a very regional role, but, you know, is a bit, not saying challenging the dollar, but at least having a larger share. And I think that's perhaps the space where the EU can play at the moment. I mean, this is not about sort of replacing the US dollar. I think that's a wrong way of phrasing it. It's about really creating a currency that is stable, that's attractive, that is used in the European wider region. So in other words, all of our neighborhoods should increasingly be using the euro, just as the neighborhood of China increasingly will use the yuan. And, you know, we will emerge perhaps from this, and I think the tendency is in that direction, in a more multipolar currency system that has several poles, and it's not just dominated by the US dollar. And I think that is almost sort of the travel direction, because of the relative decline of the US that I think is in this pandemic actually accelerating.
If I may add something, and perhaps ask Alicia, because we had a conversation with her and Elena Rybakova in another episode of The Sound of Economics recently, about emerging markets, because you mentioned about the regional role of the euro that goes beyond the actual boundaries of the EU itself. I wonder if, Alicia, this whole conversation that we are having connects as well broadly, in terms of global issues that we have, with the liquidity crisis that is linked to the COVID-19, and what is going to be the reaction and the solutions for the emerging markets, and how those are going to play out. Is there something there as well to be considered?
Well, I think, frankly, your question is well taken, because it's going to support Guntram's point from a different perspective. And let me clarify. Already since the Mexican crisis, and we're talking 94, there was full recognition that dollar dependence, dollar debt, was a problem. And any peg to the dollar, you know, and this is Mexico, and we had many others later, Argentina, I mean, dollarization, you know, it was just bringing so many fragilities to the emerging world, which basically was the push for them to issue local denominated debt that foreign investors would tap in, which is where we are today. Think about Indonesia, Brazil, etc. That has pushed the role, although of course still limited, of emerging currencies. And if you look at even SAFE, you know, the branch of the PBOC holding the reserves, China's $3 trillion, they have Mexican peso, they have, you know, they figure, they understand that these emerging economies, if as they develop, their currencies will acquire more purchasing power. Which brings us to a much more multipolar world, maybe not necessarily full reserve currencies, but diversification currencies. And unfortunately, these economies haven't gone far enough in their stability of their currencies. So you have the real, you know, like minus 30 depreciation, huge depreciation. So, you know, investors are still rushing to the door today. So we're not yet there, absolutely. But in a way, because we're not yet there, they're suffering the consequences of dollar or proxy dollar dependence now. Why? Because their currencies are still not fully credible. The lesson to learn today will be to go even further, to really consider, and especially large economies with the ability to do so, their currencies as a big tool to reduce their external dependence. So I do think we're going to move towards a more multipolar world. And it's not only going to be the euro, Gregory surely agrees, because that was his point. It's going to be a much more multipolar world, because we need many currencies, if you think about it. I mean, the situation today is very unstable, because this dollar dependence it offers a lot, because it offers us the N minus one. The whole reference, yeah, the world refers to the dollar. But let's be frank, it also gives us lots of issues with extraterritoriality, which Europe suffers from. China, I want to add, and this is last word on this, has already announced in the two sessions that it wants to include extraterritoriality in many of its legal framework, including anti-money laundering, you name it. Why? Because this is one more way to creep into the dollar dominance, because it goes beyond the currency. Let's face it. So emerging economies, to your point, are learning this lesson. And there, I think the consequence of COVID-19, first, they will suffer a lot because they didn't become independent from the dollar, much less than us, for that matter. Imagine if we weren't in the Eurozone today. We didn't have a single currency. People don't ask themselves this question, but it's quite important. Thanks God we have an international currency for whatever size it is, because we can run independent monetary policy as a region. So the emerging economies didn't get there. And now they're suffering the consequences. So I think next step for them is to try very hard to be less dependent on the dollar. So this point pushes the argument towards Trump's multipolarity of the global financial system. Absolutely.
Now, and if I may add actually to these points that Guntram and Alicia just developed, I think, yeah, it's true that an hegemonic currency like the dollar made sense in a world where transaction costs were quite high in a way. But now actually with digitalization and a world in which switching costs between currencies, so basically it's easy to exchange currency nowadays. It's much more easy than it was before. Basically, it's true that it's easier to have this kind of multipolar monetary system that could be emerging, with a bigger role for the euro, a bigger role for the yuan, a bigger role for other emerging market currency, if they manage to fulfill the criteria that I listed before. So I agree with Alicia and Guntram that we might see a more multipolar system.
Okay, this is all kind of on the nice side of the story, because we are speaking about the possibility for each of these currencies to carve their role in this system. But a question that maybe I would like to ask to Guntram, going a little bit more in the geopolitical scenarios that we're seeing here, what if those currencies, or at least some of those currencies, are used as there is a weaponization of monetary policy to a certain extent, which can lead to other kind of issues that are a little bit less harmonic, to put it mildly.
Well, I think the weaponization of a currency is something very delicate. I think, first of all, you can only do it really if you are the dominant currency. And so far, the US really is the dominant currency. And so far also, and I think we, in all fairness, we have to say that during this crisis, they have still basically enjoyed the safe haven status. And so the money has still been flowing to the US, and the capital markets have still basically relied on the US despite all the problems that we talked about. So they are really in that position where all financial firms around the world essentially need strong access to the US dollar. But the reality is also, if that power and that provisioning of a global public good, if that is misused systematically and on a prolonged basis, it puts into question the public good status as such. And as Alicia pointed out, companies as well as countries will search for alternatives. Now, that's not an easy thing to do, but the longer these extraterritorial threats last and the bigger and more relevant they become, the more it will accelerate the tipping point where actually people will turn away. And so So in that sense, I think we are still far away from this. We should acknowledge this. And I think I agree with Alicia, the yuan is far away from really replacing the dollar, also because the capital markets are not open and not free. The euro has all its internal problems. And, you know, we here in Brussels, we know very well how far we are away from a complete monetary union, which is essentially what you need to be a credible currency, global currency. But, you know, the U.S., I think, especially under the leadership of President Trump, has been, you know, really angering a lot of international friends. And, you know, in the long term, that's not a good news for the U.S. dollar.
Thank you very much, Guntram. Indeed, we could stay a little bit longer speaking about this, but we are going to keep our eyes on the development of the issue. And I would like to thank all of you for tuning in to The Sound of Economics. Until next time, bye-bye.